Greetings. Our guest on this edition of Metanoia is Jerome Shabazz, who's the founder and CEO of the Overbrook Environmental Education Center, located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They have a long-standing tradition of teaching, exploring, introducing young people and the community, as well as the larger community beyond the Overbrook section, in environmental issues, impact studies, and how to engage in being aware of environmental issues. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Jerome Shabazz. How are you, brother? How you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you very much for the introduction and for our opportunity to connect today on our work. Appreciate it.
Good. Good to be able that you could fit us into your schedule. So this is even better. But so tell us a little bit about yourself. Share some of your personal and professional background with our audience.
Sure. You know, I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Grew up in an urban community where, you know, I had a chance to witness environmentalism firsthand from some of the pioneers who took care of our communities. And, you know, when I was coming up in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, there was lead inside of our gasoline and you had lead dust and vapors on our surfaces all over the place. And these were people that used to scrub the streets down, scrub the pavements, and have these little parties where they would wash the neighborhood down on weekends. And so they sort of gave me a really good sense of the intersection around environment and health. But I was fortunate enough to go to a technical school, Dobbins Vocational, where I learned mechanical design. And back in those days, when you first graduate, if you had good grades, you were eligible to go to a co-op where you could work with a company. And so I had the opportunity to work with a company called Omni Engineering. And it was owned by an African-American civil engineer and licensed surveyor. His name was Lyman H. Stiles. And Stiles was a phenomenal person. He had multiple offices around the country, and his primary office was in Philadelphia. And I was fortunate enough to work in his organization. He had a small but very efficient organization. But everybody had to be a part of everything. And so what he enabled me to do was to be a part of all of the projects. I was a draftsman. He hired me as a draftsman. When I graduated, I stayed on in the company. And he was, I would always see the plans and the designs, and I had a lot of questions, and he was never tiring of the questions that I asked about what was happening. And so from the drawing board, I eventually went into the field as a technician. And as a technician, we were doing a lot of what we call inflow and infiltration studies. And that was where you had townships all around the state and even outside of the state where residents were making the decision on whether they wanted to go from having wells to having municipally treated water. And so we would do sewer inspections to prepare for that. And it just opened my mind up to a whole new sphere of how our civilization is run, who's running it, how it's designed, and the relationships that go along with it. And I remember one time I was looking at a plan, and it said going to a wastewater treatment plant facility. So all of the waste would go to a wastewater treatment plant. And I had no idea what that meant. And I went back to this employer of mine and said, well, what is this wastewater treatment plant facility thing? And he said, look, I'm busy. If you really want to know, take a course. So that's what I did. I took a course and learned wastewater and water treatment plant. It was really a correspondence course, a Sacramento, California course. And I got a license as a, they said, you know, whoever passes the course, you should get a license to be an operator in your state. And I got certified in the state where I live. And it sort of opened up a whole new opportunity because I was called to get a job in the city of Philadelphia when they were expanding their wastewater treatment plant facility. And it just sort of took me on this trajectory that sort of led me to where I am today. But, you know, it was a very organic relationship that I had from, you know, my upbringing to my professional life. And we could talk more about that as we go through the conversation.
Well, how did you move from that to where you are now at the Overbrook Environmental Education Center? How did that area come to your attention? And then what did you do about it?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I worked for two engineering firms, Omni Engineering and D.S. Winokur and Associates. And I was working on water treatment systems and water treatment facility design and sort of engineer by profession. I wasn't thinking about it, but all of those people who passed that exam were asked to apply for the city of Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plant facilities so that they have capacity to expand their wastewater treatment plant. They were going from primary to secondary treatment. And I said, why not? And applied and got into the city government working on the water and wastewater treatment plant facilities. I was at a very unique place at a unique time because they were expanding the facilities. And then I got back into the engineering side of things. And I was sort of managing some of the documents. And what happens as a result is that you not only are transferring the documents from engineering to the operations division, but then you have a lot of students and citizens who want to know what's going on with this process. And so I was the guy giving tours as well to explain to mainly college students what was happening with these sites. And then I started to realize that I wasn't seeing a lot of local talent. I wasn't seeing a lot of local schools, or primarily I wasn't seeing any African-American students coming in. And I was questioning, why is it that, you know, I'm doing tours for counties outside of Philadelphia? Why am I doing tours for students who are not from the region? What's the story about making certain that all the citizens have access to these resources? I mean, if we're the fifth, sixth largest city in the country, we have some interesting infrastructure that people can learn from. And so the response that I was getting is that there were these third parties who accommodated the students. There were these environmental organizations, these nonprofits who accommodated the students in their quest to learn from those municipal resources. And then I started to question, well, where are they in North Philly? And where are they in South Philly? Where are they in West Philly, the neighborhoods that I was familiar with? And I couldn't find it. And so my wife and I, we said that we were already running a nonprofit organization for adult training. We said, well, why don't we see if we can work with the schools and help them gain greater access to environmental resources? And therein was born an opportunity. At the time, we had two kids who were going to Overbrook High School, and they said, hey, we have a service learning community out here, and we could really use some help. Maybe we could set up a meeting. And sure enough, we talked to the district superintendent and coordinator and principal of Overbrook High School, and we started doing programs. And so our programs were significant in that they were project-based, students were learning by doing. And we started seeing these sort of modest uptick in the grades of the students. And I said, well, if I'm going to, they asked, well, can you come back again next year? I said, well, if I do, I would really like to have a curriculum. So I wrote a curriculum and I got some funding for the curriculum. And the funding enabled us to have supplement the time of other teachers to get involved. So we got the math teachers involved, and English teachers, and science teachers involved. And the curriculum itself was called the Overbrook Environmental Education Center. And that's how we actually got our name. And so now we have this structured model, adopting creeks, adopting streams. So we adopted the neighborhood park, Indian Creek that's inside the park, Morris Park. And we had students doing, you know, leaf identification. So we started getting more into the structure of science with the curriculum. Grades started going up again. And so now we get the attention of the district and there and people were involved. It's like, wow, this is looking good because our kids don't usually do that well in STEM. Definitely don't see upward trajectories around their performance. And then, what ended up happening was that they said, well, look, we would love to see a third year so that we can make sure that this is a trend and that what you're doing is really making a difference. And sure enough, the district became more interested and teachers were more involved, meaning that we had more coordinated meetings and discussions. And we found that we had these three years of consecutive great performance and interest from the students, which everybody was excited about. So that's sort of how we got into this space of public education and environment was through working with some young people. And the final outcome was that we had an assessment with the teachers and talked about, what do you think we're doing well? Well, I said, well, it's a couple of things. They said, one, you're more nimble and you can do things that we can't do well in our structured environment.
Classroom, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can reach out to people. You can schedule activities and things like that. So we need that external partner. That's one. And two, the idea of project-based learning, we know what that is now, but back then they weren't using quite those terms. That whole idea of like engagement and being a part of something was a powerful part of our methodology. They said, we need you to build a place. And it sounds bizarre when I even say it now. The teachers are telling me that they need me to build an institution for them. Like, where does all that resource come from? But we didn't shy away from it. And we went back to the students and said, look, what do you guys think about all this? And their response was very specific. It said, look, what you're talking about and what we see is not lining up. Why is it so much trash and so mm-hmm. much degradation right. in our right. neighborhood? And you keep talking about the need for it to be healthy. And so we made a pact with them. We said, look, if you're serious and you're willing to work on this, I said, because some of it is political, some of it is racial, some of it's racism involved. When you talk about redlining and conditions of neighborhoods, it's the economics involved. If you're willing to unpack all of that, then we can unpack all of that and we'll do it with you. And so we started looking for a site that we can use as a demonstration site for our work. And that site is where we are now on Lancaster Avenue. It turns out that there's a whole lot more resource to it than we ever could imagine. But we actually acquired a location and we made the students a part of the remediation of that particular site.
Now, what you found was an abandoned quarry. So how did that come about, and how did you secure the resources to acquire the property and then begin the program? Because you've done a myriad of different programs there. So how did all that come about?
So it's a couple of different things that happened. The background of the site itself, I was working with these wonderful folks who were actually working through the water department. This guy named Adam Levine. He's probably one of the premier historians about underground infrastructure in the city. And I said, Adam, I said, if I can find resources for you, would you be willing to give us a report on what the history of our location represents, particularly around its environmental impacts? So if there are any historical creeks or streams, what watersheds were connected to, historically how the land use was allocated, et cetera. And Levine came back with this wonderful report that was extraordinary. It turns out that our location was the Rowley's Quarry. It was a rock quarry that was used to mine for rock and stone that was used to build houses in the neighborhood.
Houses, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the early 1900s. And it showed how we were connected very geographically to the Schuylkill River watershed, Delaware River watershed. And we thought that was phenomenal. considering that we were going to be this ultra urban environmental center, that we were connected geographically to both watersheds, which is rare, you know, usually connected to one or the other, but we were sort of just positioned in a way that we could have impact on both. And it was a site that had a lot of, it had tree canopy, it had old buildings, it had a little bit of everything. I mean, if you're talking about education and development and demonstrating what best practices could look like, that site was sort of a perfect site. So when we acquired it, it was an acre site, and it had three buildings on it. And part of the big deal for us became its historical use. And so one of the things we were good about, even to this day, is deconstructing big issues. And when we started to deconstruct the different issues and different impacts of the site, then there are resources that are connected to the specific issue. So one of the big issues that was occurring in our neighborhood was flooding or combined sewer overflow. So, you know, in the city of Philadelphia and many cities around the country, you have collector systems to collect stormwater. And if those collector systems overflow, it dumps into a sanitary system. And that sanitary system, if it overflows, it'll release contaminated waste.
Waste, yeah.
Streams. And that's, you know, that's illegal, and it's something that's undesirable because you're polluting as a result of not having the capacity to manage your stormwater. And so, you know, the challenge is either you create more surfaces where stormwater could go right into the ground, what they call impervious surface, pervious surfaces, or you disconnect the stormwater from the sanitary waste system. And, you know, Philadelphia did a study, and that was happening when I was there. It was going to cost at that time, which is almost 20 years ago, almost 15 years ago. It's like, you know, it would have cost $1.2 billion to disconnect all of this, and city didn't have money. And so what they did was they created a Green Cities Clean Water Plan that would incentivize the city over a 25-year period of time to disconnect the stormwater from the sanitary system and incentivize people through credits to have more stormwater collected on site. So you had these green stormwater infrastructure systems. And so what we did was we said, well, what if we could create a site that could collect stormwater and take some of the burden off of the collector system that's leading to flooding in that neighborhood? And that was one of our projects we started working on, you know, getting state resources, some federal resources for working on these stormwater management systems. And that sort of was the start of how we started to modify and correct the site. And then we just started doing things in a very programmatic way. So when we wanted to work with, you know, the agricultural side of it, we partnered with groups that did agricultural work. We wanted to do things that dealt with heat island effect. We dealt with energy related organizations that did that. We just created these network of partners who never really gave us resources to deal with the capacity of the physical management of the site, but they gave us insight and sort of co-production of knowledge. And so we knew what we had to do. And the only thing we had in our advantage was time. So we took our time, something that maybe a more well-resourced organization could have gotten done in a year. Wow. It may have taken us five. but it was a lot of education we got out of that. So I think the answer to the question is creating really good partnerships and being able to deconstruct our facility and our project into project experiences that we could sort of fund and resource.
Now, how were you able to get the residents to buy into it, even though they were impacted by the stormwater management issues that were surrounding, that they were experiencing? How were you able to get the community to come on board and be supportive of what you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it happens sort of extemporaneously, and other times it has to be very deliberate. So the extemporaneous thing or the thing that just happened was that people started seeing a transformation of the site. Now, just keep in mind, the facilities that we acquired were abandoned facilities. They were not used to their capacity. The built facilities, you know, the quarry was there in the early 1900s, 1919, 1920. And they filled those in and they built the roadways and all of those kinds of infrastructural developments over probably a course of 30 years. But then in the 1950s, there was more actual development on the commercial corridor. So our site was built in 1956. It was a supermarket, it was a wine and spirit shop, it was a pizza parlor. So those three businesses were on a site and probably operated up until the 1980s when a lot of supermarkets strategically decided to go into a mall models where you're creating these malls on the outskirts of cities where they have more land and they can have more cross generation of revenue. I have other stores and people going to supermarkets. So the supermarkets anchored the malls and then they left the inner city and went to these malls. So when that happened in our particular case, the Philadelphia Building Supply Company came in. And this was probably like a Stanley Hardware or steroids, a very, very small version, Home Depot and Lowe's, who were in the South and weren't quite Northeast at the time. But I think when they did come up in the Northeast, they may have ran those people out of business because they just left everything. They didn't move the business, they just left the business. Mm-hmm. Interesting because that helped to define a lot of the environmental hazards that we acquired on the site. So when we got to the site, there were tons of like pesticides, herbicides, cases, and all kinds of things that were deteriorating in containers, leaking out, and it became a hazardous condition. So as we started cleaning that stuff up, on one hand, it was just the neighbors realizing, wow, I used to not want to walk past this place. And they would give it, we have testimony from neighbors that I just avoided walking by that whole site because it was not lit, it was dark. It had, you know, debris outside and inside. It looked ominous. It didn't feel like something that was attractive. The only business that was operating by the time we acquired it was the wine and spirit shop. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't your mainline wine and cheese soiree kind of place. it was absolutely the kind of place you wanted to avoid. And so eventually we began to seek out different kind of partners. We got a grant from a phenomenal organization called the Community Design Collaborative. I think at the time they were a division of the American Institute of Architecture. And the Community Design Collaborative, their role was to provide technical services, technical support around architecture and planning for nonprofit organizations. And a short story was that I had read an article in the Philadelphia Magazine, and there was this guy named Ty Woodward, and he was writing this article about the need for inner city organizations to do more around the environment. And I'm like, that's us. It sounds like you're describing
me. Right in our lap, yeah.
And I think I wrote Todd a letter and said, hey, look, you know, if that's what you're interested in, then we're the ones. And he said, well, look, you know, sounds great. I'm connected to the Community Design Collaborative. He turned us on to communities. And we applied and we got an actual grant. And the grant really entitled us to multiple architectural firms and engineering firms that helped us with the planning and the reuse of the site. And that's when we started to really think about how we can collect stormwater on the site and how we can maintain urban forests and how we can, you know, use the site as an educational laboratory, if you will. And so Community Design Collaborative have been great partners. I'm actually on the board now, the board of directors of the organization. I feel so strongly about the work that they've done to help, you know, a burgeoning nonprofit really get its footing. But yeah, I think that's the deal. So what we've been able to do as a result of the Community Design Collaborative, we had to have charrettes and we had to have this sort of community engagement not just around the existing conditions, but what do you want to see the future site look like? Mm-hmm. And that was the very intentional part of how we engage the community around, what do you think this should look like? And how do you feel about it? Right. And more recently, we used Jefferson University and their architectural school to help us to do charrettes for planning of our site and what we think are necessary benefits and co-benefits of developing facilities. So we've had charrettes and community meetings and community engagement on one side. And then on the other side is just being a good neighbor, you know, and having people come out and say, hey, wow, what are you doing? But ultimately, you know, we've got to the point where we have programs where neighbors come out. Like we do nutrition programs and things like that with neighbors.
Actually, yeah, come you out. Also, in addition to involving these agencies, because you're involved with the Environmental Protection Agency, you're involved with several city agencies. You partner in addition to Jefferson University. There are other local colleges and universities you're partnering with, and you're still with the school district, but haven't you expanded beyond Overbrook High School?
Oh, yeah. Since we've gotten started, we've probably had over 40,000 students that have been on site working on various projects, working with about six different universities that actively work on the site to provide students. A lot of the interns do their internships here on the site. I had a young man from Tuskegee who got his doctorate degree and is doing a lot of his thesis work with us. So we have a lot of students who, that's a big part of our work, our student engagement, whether it's creating opportunities for interns. And probably the last 10 years, we've been taking a very strong leadership role in the area of environmental justice. And so a lot of students very intentionally want to learn about environmental justice and what that means, climate justice. How does the ideas around climate and environment benefit the people who need it most in urban communities and poor communities? And so we've been operating in that space as well. But yeah, we're way beyond Overbrook High School now. We work with a whole host of schools all around the city, both private and nonprofit, and outside of the city. We have programs that we operate outside of Philadelphia as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, one time I was there and you were doing urban agriculture. Mm-hmm. So do you still do that? And you still have that structure there where you're growing plants and vegetables on site?
Yeah. So, you know, to step back a little bit, you know, there are four primary areas of interest that we have at the site. You know, one is an environment, mm-hmm. Public health, agriculture, literacy, and art. So it's five areas of interest. And the agricultural side, you know, we look at it from two perspectives. One, you know, we're in a food desert area where there are very few walkable, healthy food establishments in the neighborhood. You know, USDA usually references, you know, a location that's a mile or 1.2 miles away from a healthy food establishment is typically designated as a food desert. And we just don't have access to the healthy foods. And so we know that impacts on public health. It's sort of a domino effect. It affects right. everything, your viability, your motivation, your ability to even work. You know, it's just tied to your health and your energy. And so we specifically targeted our site as a demonstration for what it looks like to have locally grown food. And so we have two high tunnel greenhouses now. I think where you came, we only had one.
Right.
Two, where we grow local vegetables. And really the idea for us is not to compete with the markets that are already out there, but really to more so demonstrate on the nutrition side what that looks like. Our perspective is, even around healthy and vibrant and robust communities, you need healthy people. You know, you won't have a sustainable and robust community, a thriving community. One thing that my father used to always tell me, he said, you know, it's not always about how much money you make, it's how much you can keep. And if a vast majority of your money is going to doctors and medicine, doctor visits, and those kinds of things, it's gonna have
one, to keep one of the challenges is that in our community, a lot of times they don't have the money to set aside for medical or healthcare, even with the recent changes in health insurance. So yeah. That's the challenge, you know. Their budget is siphoned off on other things. So healthcare, while it is important, it's not a priority.
It's not a priority, and that's something that we try to change that. We try to create, in many ways, what we like to call new norms, right? Everything that we deal with relative to our community partners, we try to answer internally three questions. What's the issue? Why should this community person care? And what can they do about it once they know what the issues are, right? What is the issue? Why should they care? What can they do about it? You know, Philadelphia is unique is that it's one of the biggest, poorest counties in the United States. And so if people are operating on 35 to 42% poverty in certain neighborhoods, then their priorities are driven by that, right? So having a conversation about urban agriculture doesn't resonate with a person who's worried about, you know, their child eating at night or worrying about keeping the house warm in the wintertime, cool in the summer, or dealing with that geriatric parent. All of these other priorities are, in some cases, taking precedent to some of the things that we talk about. But what we try to do is to elevate the environmental work in the conversation when we explain how much it impacts those areas that they're concerned about. How it impacts your economy, how it impacts your health, how it impacts your relationships with your family. You know, if I were to go into a classroom, and I do this a lot, and I say, well, how many people know about the idea of sustainability? You may not see a whole lot of hands go up. But then if I say, you know, how many of you know about climate adaptation and climate change? You may not see a whole lot of hands go up. But if I say, how many of you in this room have asthma? Half the room hands go up. Mm-hmm. How many of you have hypertension or high blood pressure, have to pass
allergies,
right? Mm-hmm. They can see the environmental conditions relative to their health. And what we try to do is to help them understand that those connections are real, those connections can be managed, and those connections will lead to a healthier, more viable quality of life.
Now you talked about environmental justice. Because climate change and climate adaptation and adaptability are the buzzwords of the day. But for you, what is environmental justice? Because you talked about poverty, you talked about how the awareness of surrounding our immediate community and that the quality of life issues and the standard of the community. A lot of times people don't think about it. It's not in the forefront of their mind, but it does impact them. It does impact their health. It does impact their psychological well-being or, on the other side, mental illness. So what is environmental justice for you, and what does that look like?
Environmental justice is really under the same guidance of what Martin Luther King said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And when we think about environmental justice, it's that one particular group of people or organizations or people are not disproportionately impacted by the environmental conditions around them. And so when we look at the epidemiology of neighborhoods, we look at the conditions within neighborhoods, we see that there are certain communities who are more burdened by the impacts of the, or mainly the cumulative impacts of environmental conditions. So in a very practical sense, most industries produce a byproduct, right? And the more robust the industry, the more robust the byproduct they produce. They produce waste, they produce gases, they have vehicles, they have chemicals that are used in that industrialized processing. And those conditions, those industrialized conditions, post-industrial conditions, probably 90%, I think, very conservatively, are in communities of color all throughout the country and in native tribes, right? Mm-hmm. So, tribes and African-American poor communities. So you lose poverty, race, geography. You can identify by the zip code where contamination lies. And it's happening in very predictable places. And then, you know, so the question becomes, how did it become so predictable? And arguably, most of the researchers are suggesting that the geography really started with redlining, where there is these federal programs that actually designated fundable and resource non-fundable and non-resource communities. So even recently in Pennsylvania, it's sort of incredible that you had Josh Shapiro,
Attorney General,
Attorney General, people like Vincent Hughes, state and other state representatives who actually went after one of the mortgage companies that was known for this redlining and held them accountable for it. I think there was some financial remuneration that they had to provide to the community as a result of their work. They specifically and very intentionally disinvested in certain neighborhoods. And that divestiture created these sort of dilapidated, under-resourced community structures that now are revealing environmental health hazards. So these are the places that have excessive amounts of lead, excessive amounts of asbestos, excessive amounts of other contaminants of metals that are arguably directly connected to the health of the people in those communities.
What we're also seeing is that the history of particularly these East Coast cities,
yes,
the early industrial, you know, the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. where you had factories in these neighborhoods, right. Factories go down, the people left, they went out to the industrial parks, so they left altogether, or there was technological disruption that you know, eliminated that whole industry altogether. Mm-hmm. But the physical remnants of that activity are still there, and they tend to be in these communities that are, resource deserts. And you talked about redlining, and you talked about the disinvestment. So that compounds what you're talking about, because it goes back and deals with the historical implications of why the community is the way it is, because of the way the city developed.
Yeah, and as I referenced early on, I went to a conference in Oklahoma City that was sponsored by the EPA on a designated terminology for these kinds of neighborhoods called brownfields. You know, and they these post-industrial, underutilized, in many cases, abandoned facilities that used to represent industry, and the contamination continues to linger in those spaces. And as the buildings and the facilities begin to deconstruct, it makes it undesirable for people to want to even acquire them. And so they continue to deteriorate, and it becomes a source of pollution and contamination in those neighborhoods. And it does have real impact. There are people, and I deal with, I'm on Environmental Justice Commissions, National Environmental Justice Commissions, statewide and citywide. And I've been, particularly in the federal or state or national commissions, we see people giving testimony of their children being poisoned, or an entire block with cancer, you know, that was right across the street from an industrial process. And we call those fence line communities, because the only thing you see these, you know, cyclone fence, but that's the only thing that's separating you from the hazard. And yeah, so we can identify the contamination, hazards, the waste by zip code, probably in many cases, a confluence of what you're talking about with this post-industrial land use, along with the disinvestment, redlining, leads up to today, where we have these communities that are under-resourced and have been divested in such a way that it's unhealthy.
All right, so give us your contact information, where you're located, what's your phone number, because this is a critical part of our culture and our society as we go forward, because we're seeing gentrification, and you were talking about, you know, the fence situation. Well, we saw that last year or 2 years ago in Kensington, where the neighborhood had been gentrified, but the kids were getting sick and the parents were wondering what was going on. Come to find out, the community was built over a former plant or something, and there's toxic waste and contaminants in the environment that weren't picked up by the inspectors or anybody else, or they just turned a blind eye to it. Mm-hmm. So give us your contact information so people can get some more information about what you're doing.
Sure. So you can, our website is www.overbrookcenter.org. You can reach us by email at info@overbrookcenter.org. Our direct telephone number is 215-879-7770. And yeah, we welcome your communications. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about our work. It's very important work. We're at a time now where, you know, our politicians are talking about the issue. The president signed a bill about environment and climate. You know, in this region, relative to climate, we need to adapt. I mean, we are getting warmer and we're getting wetter in this region, and people need to adapt to that. There are health conditions that will be exacerbated by heat and wet conditions. We need to be more vigilant of our relatives and our elderly and our vulnerable populations, and just make certain that we can learn how to coexist with our environment, that we have the tools to adapt, to mitigate the conditions that are ultimately changing around us, and to keep our fellow citizens, relatives, and friends healthy and viable throughout it all.
Well, we still have a few more minutes, so we're not ready to close out yet. But okay. You mentioned the charrettes, and for folks that don't know, that's when the architects and planners come in, and they either engage the community about a project, or it's an intellectual or a planning exercise where they create a plan for a community. Mm-hmm. And see, you're involved. You're in the room. You're at the table. Oftentimes, decisions are made and the public is not there. So share some tips and information on how people can become engaged. I mean, a lot of times they just overlook the community. How can community get in the room and be at the table?
That's a good point. So one of the fortunate things that we have at our disposal now are a couple of tools. You know, one of the tools is that the President Biden, his administration, has created some executive orders, and he's created a framework for engagement of every agency. It's called Justice 40. And this framework informs that 40% of all of the resources of all federal agencies have to benefit environmental justice communities. These are the communities that are very intentionally, historically being have been divested against. And these are communities where people do not have the resources to help themselves. All agencies across the board, whether it's Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, the EPA, their resources have to benefit these communities. So when we hear about infrastructural development happening in communities, we should be able to very intentionally ask, how are the environmental justice, how are the most disinvested, historically disinvested communities, how are they going to be benefited by this work? So if you hear about some construction happening, if you hear about some development happening, if it's federal dollars involved, you have the right to ask about that. The other part of it is too, Title VI. I mean, there's very strong connections, and the Biden administration has made those connections between environmental injustice and civil rights. And so it's been argued in many cases, successfully so, that the civil rights of citizens have been violated by way of the accumulated burdens that have been placed on them environmentally. And so when you can identify that there are a host of environmental impacts that are taking place in a very specific area, that there may be some relief by way of understanding how these things are affecting a person's civil rights. So Title VI, Justice 40, Biden administration's executive orders on environmental justice are all three tools that are very helpful in identifying how you can get relief around developments that are taking place in the federal funding.
The other question is, you're talking about situations where there are new projects coming up,
right,
and how people can find out about them and then become engaged. What about, and that's being proactive, what about the type of reactionary situations like what happened in Kensington or what happened, just using Philadelphia as an example, of the people in I can't remember the exact section where the houses started to collapse
and big
sinkholes and the whole blocks of houses, the structure of the houses. That clearly is an environmental problem. It's a planning problem. It's a public health issue. It's a public safety issue. How can people become involved in those kinds of situations?
Right. So currently, we're fortunate that 2 years ago, the city of Philadelphia created an environmental justice advisory council. And the Environmental Justice Advisory Council is specifically seated for the purposes of being able to address these kinds of impacts on communities. And the Office of Sustainability manages the work of this department. So if someone is in Philadelphia region and Philadelphia County, and they had some, or they suspected that they had some environmental issues, they should be able to reach out to the Office of Sustainability, who can in turn share that information with this Environmental Justice Advisory Council. And this is a council that's made up of citizens, people who either work or live in Philadelphia. And their explicit charge is to investigate and look into these issues and help to come up with remedy to keep our citizens safe. And so, there's commissions not only on city level, but there's an advisory environmental justice advisory board on state level as well, and they have an equal charge, but that's for the entire Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So we have these advisories on the state and municipal levels, and we should use them to get a better sense of what's going on. And here's the thing that I think is important to understand. You don't have to be a scientist, or you don't have to be an
engineer.
Engineer to know what your experiences are telling you. And one of the things, Junius, that I'm an advocate for is elevating the stature of experiential learners. And so that when we're in these rooms, you know, oftentimes you have your PhDs and your professors, and I deliberately say, I don't try to out academic the academic, but I also want my experience and lived experience to be recognized.
Right, your anecdotal experiences, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anecdotal, yeah. So that the person who knows that five people on their block had cancer and nobody else had the same relative experience, you know, four blocks away, but you know that this industrial facility is right across the street. I mean, you could see the data. I mean, the information's there. The health department puts out information where cancer risks are, where, you know, hypertension, they have all that stuff broken down by neighborhood. So you could see the relationship. And if someone is experiencing something that they know, that's a great indicator. And oftentimes we have a lot of our research partners through academic and research partners studying these things. And even though I was shocked when I came into certain information, they're like, oh yeah, we've been studying this up for years. So what do you do with this information?
Yeah.
And that changed our relationship with our academic partners. That we've deemed it unacceptable that you know about these potential hazards and risks and not have a methodology by which you can share with the communities that you've been doing the research on. So I think to answer your question very specifically, I think whether it's people in this part of the country or otherwise, you know, seek out those environmental justice organizations who are committed to helping you gain voice around solving some of these problems, because they can be quite complicated. Oftentimes the opponents are pretty reasonable.
Well-funded
businesses, industries who would much rather you think that, you know, you're delirious or imagining things versus having the actual facts about the impact.
But even when they themselves do have the facts, but they'll try to gaslight you about.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, right. That's interesting too, because we found that certain industries, some of them through different tools that investigators and even journalists use, they're finding out that these people have had information about the harms of their ways for years.
So one last thing before you go, we've talked about urban because that's where you are,
right?
But you also have experience dealing statewide with rural communities. And so you have a lot of times, you mentioned early on, you have a community that's contemplating going from stormwater collection wells, septic tanks to municipal services, waste management, and water. So what are some things that people who are in that position need to know and some of the resources that they can call upon to make sure that they're making the right decision? Because a lot of times there is toxic material in the soil and they're not even aware of it. This is seeping into their wells or seeping into their septic tanks. So what can folks do in situations like that?
Well, I tell you, you know, you're absolutely right that many of our rural areas are suffering because they in many cases don't have the resources to change the systematic impact. And they're being impacted by upstream contaminants of other actors, which, you know, is a problem in of itself. I mean, if you're in a region where somebody has agricultural manufacturing, or they might be doing some fracking or some, you know, then it may affect your water tables. It may impact you completely. There's no magic wand, but the reality is people have to stay active in their political representation. It doesn't cost you anything to ask your political representatives what they're thinking is about that problem, right? Bring that problem to their attention to make that part of their platform. And at the very minimum, if they want your vote and support, they need to have that issue as part of their agenda. Your water quality, your air quality, quality of your land, and that no one else should be able to burden that condition for you. you know, when the president talks about this is a once in a lifetime kind of investment, I mean, if you start seeing the numbers are not just, you know, I talk about urban environments because that's, you know, primarily our constituency. And most people, quite frankly, live in urban settings. But in those rural settings where resources might not be as great, tax bases may not be as high, folks have to begin to engage their representatives more around, you know, what kind of resources are available. Because I've seen funds specifically designed for people who had to, you know, repurpose their septic tank systems and their wells and for checking and monitoring their well water quality and the impacts on their water quality through the watersheds that they're in. All of those things are available now for these new, more recent bills. And the question is, how can you access them? And many of the people that I know in rural areas are accessing them through their political representatives who can tell them exactly where the funds are. They usually allocate these funds in two ways, through grants, direct grants, and through allocations to the states. And so the allocations to the states obviously require representation of those state representatives to help you access.
Last question, and then we'll let you go. How can someone who's interested in this area contact you to become an intern or get more information, come out, see what you're doing, and also just maybe shadow some of your folks just to learn what's going on?
Yeah, well, we get asked a lot, so it's really about capacity and time, but you know, we're always open because that's what we do. I mean, we fortunately have people on our staff and team who love what they do. You can look at our webpage at www.overbrookcenter.org. You can look at our Facebook page, connected directly through our webpage, but you can reach out to us at info@overbrookcenter.org. And if you are old school like me, you can just pick up the phone and call at 215-879-7770. And we would love to hear your responses, see what kind of things you're dealing with. We love collaboration. You know, we realize that the conditions that we have environmentally didn't happen through one act or one period of time, overnight. And the solution is not going to be that way either. We're going to have to come together. We're going to have to work together. And you'll be surprised as to what skill sets people bring to this process. And we work with a lot of different folks. You know, going back to how we start to grow in our capacity, we just started working with different people who had different skills. And we made it easy for people to be able to coexist and co-produce. And so I think our greatest strategic benefit is that we create this human environment where people can feel as though they can thrive and do what they do well and be appreciated, respected for their effort and contribution.
Well, that's one thing you can say about me. I definitely appreciate what you, your wife started and what you guys are doing and how you're doing it. So very appreciative and hats off to you and the Overbrook Environmental and Education Center and all your programs and how you've been engaging with the community and being sort of a bridge between the community, grassroots folks, and all these other policymakers, decision makers, and to bring folks together so they can accomplish things.
Well, yes. And you know, we use the analogy that we're the ligament that holds the muscle to the bone. You know, and so we keep trying to connect. If we have this follow, we have a follow-up conversation this time next year. Our goal is to have we're beginning starting next month an infrastructural improvement project that's going to allow us to have a very exciting institute at our center that's going to be targeted towards interpreting what's happening in the neighborhood environmentally. So we're going to be working with partners, university partners, that will enable us to have, you know, monitoring of heat, monitoring of air, monitoring of water. So we're going to give neighborhoods sort of like a report card of what's happening around, and then come up with some wonderful solutions for what you could do on certain kinds of conditions, certain types of days, what we can do to make the environment healthier. You know, we still have issues that really cause serious problems that can be mitigated quite easily, like litter. You know, litter, people don't realize that when that litter washes below grade into those catchment systems, mm-hmm. becomes very expensive, dangerous, creates a habitat for mosquitoes and other kind of rodents. You know, there's things that we can do at our own neighborhood level that can make a huge difference. And now that we're creating these sort of bioretention systems that collect stormwater on site, litter now is doing twice as much damage, right? Because now your hydrology systems are being interrupted, and it can contribute to flooding and all other kinds of problems. So, you know, we talk about these. We actually have a group now that we're called the Philly Green Ambassadors. And Philly Green Ambassadors are folks who are frontline folks. They work. They have jobs with nonprofit organizations, and they help to clean up litter in the communities. But we give them training, and we're probably halfway through a 15-week training course where we're training them about the environment and how what they do benefits the environment. And it's amazing how people love doing work that's helping others. Right. When you can find a community benefit in what you do, you would do it for free if you didn't need the money. And so, you know, we always ask people that, you know, what would you like to do if you didn't have the burden of having to get a salary? What would you do? And that's sort of, it gives you a little insight on what that person's all about. And right. we try to accommodate that. And we find that the folks that are doing the work, you know, in the Philly Green Ambassador Program, these are people who just love making sure that people are happy, the neighborhoods are clean. They talk about all the other things that they do for the neighbors. It's just a phenomenal work. We call it the community of the willing. These are people who know how to get past their own self-interest to benefit the people around them and the community that they live in. And so we're doing training around that, very intentional training, but we're finding that it has this real exponential benefit of helping people find pride and reasons for getting up in the morning and doing what they do.
Right. All right, brother. This has been a great learning experience to reintroduce what you're doing, because I saw you in a limited capacity. It was more dealing with the students.
Right. And
with the urban agricultural piece last time I was there. But I've seen you branched out. And again, you are that bridge between the community and the policymakers and the academics. So I appreciate what you do. Well, any final thoughts before we let you go?
Well, final thoughts is pollution is in the dose. So let's try to reduce our exposure to pollution and hazardous waste that's going to impact our health. You want to be viable. You want to be healthy. And I think the way we can do that is to just be aware of what we expose ourselves to and the amount of time that we spend in those environments. And so, you know, the old timers did a good job, you know, in keeping us safe. And the legacy and investment that we can make in our future generation is to do the same for them. So that's the inheritance that we want to try to pass down, is one where there's an environment where people can thrive, they can feel healthy and viable and inspired. You know, when we feel good, I think we feel inspired. So we want to go from that derogatory space to a healthy space. And I thank you for the opportunity for having this conversation. I think it's an important conversation. Glad to have it.
Definitely, definitely important, definitely topical and on time. And we appreciate you taking time out from your busy schedule to be with us.
Thank you so much. We'll
let you go. And again, with our eternal gratitude and thanks.
Appreciate it. Thank you.